Welcome to the Legacy Podcast Series from Chapter 4 Uganda. Visit us at chapter4uganda.org to subscribe, receive a newsletter and updates on our work and that of our partners on civil liberties in Uganda. Dr. Zahara Nampewo, welcome to this Legacy Podcast Series by Chapter 4. My name is Angelo Izama. I would love to introduce you myself because, you know, we have a long history. But for those who might be hearing of you for the first time, would you like to introduce yourself, how you came to be involved with the law, and why you care so much about human rights and human rights issues in Uganda?
Thank you, Angelo. It's good to be here. And especially because of Chapter 4, to which I am the board chair. I have been for a while, and it is a role that I do with passion because, you know, human rights is second nature to me. I am currently the deputy principal at the School of Law, Makerere University. That means that I am in charge of the academic docket at the school since 2022 November. Previous to that, I was the director for the Human Rights and Peace Center. In short, we call HURIPEC. The center is a semi-autonomous unit and academic center of the School of Law at Makerere University, responsible for the teaching and supporting the teaching of human rights and human rights related courses at the School of Law, but also university-wide. We support the teaching of human rights and ethics to students doing journalism, students doing international relations, students doing medicine, and other courses. So I'm in charge of the academics right now, but for the last 8 years, from 2014 to 2022, I was also in charge of the Human Rights and Peace Center, which really did the teaching of human rights, but also research and advocacy. HURIPEC worked as a center, but also collaboratively with other centers and units, academic and non-academic, across the world. And we pride ourselves in the collaborations that we've had, both North and South, working really on issues of rights and governance. I am also currently, as I mentioned earlier, the board chair for Chapter 4 Uganda. My background, really, how did I stumble into human rights is that I think my studies, my educational background is largely in human rights. When I completed my diploma in legal practice at the Law Development Center, my first calling was a posting in a human rights NGO called the Foundation for Human Rights Initiative. And therefrom, I did a master's degree in human rights and followed that up with a PhD in gender and sexuality. So really, I do have a strong educational background in human rights, but also the passion to work in rights, and my teaching and my publications have really been in this area of rights, governance, focusing on disability, gender, health, justice, and such, okay. Such issues. Thank you.
So we're going to talk a little bit about how your years of service at the university, how that is translating to the advisory role you play for a civil liberties organization like Chapter 4 Uganda, which is, I think, now 10 years old, as one of the active civil liberties organizations. So would you say that the wall between academia, on the one hand, and the business of dealing with civil liberties from the ground level at Chapter 4, and I'm talking about, you know, Chapter 4 is a legal organization. Often you're dealing with problematic situations, you know, human rights violations, arrests, disappearances, in some cases, large-scale human rights violations, massacres, and that sort of thing. How would you say has been the interaction between your work as a teacher and an advisor, and then coming face to face with this, you know, the real business of like confronting human rights challenges in a country like Uganda?
First of all, Makerere University played a very big role in the independence of Uganda. It is a symbol of not only academic freedom, but the very independence of the country. And that is why we have the Freedom Square at Makerere University, a big, large green space where, you know, students used to go and talk about issues of governance and rights. And we also lost lives. We lost student lives in the struggle for independence. Makerere University is alma mater to past presidents, President Mkapa of Tanzania, and many public intellectuals. So the university by itself plays a unique role. It has a unique historical importance in democratic struggles and has been at the core of contestations for democratization. We do have a strong academic staff association that has been a voice for both academic, non-academic, as well as persons outside of the university on issues of rights, teachers' rights, secondary school teachers' rights. And I think it is no surprise that our first African vice chancellor, the first African vice chancellor of Makerere University, the late Frank Kalimuzo, who was appointed in 1970, was murdered, abducted and murdered in 1972 by the then political regime of Idi Amin, which really means that, you know, the university, the oldest university in Uganda by itself, had a strong place. It played a strong role in the democratization process, in speaking out about human rights violations in the country.
But are you not saying really something as obvious as Makerere University being the place where, you know, Uganda was producing its human capital? So I'm talking about professionals after colonialism who, by design, were going to inherit the country and manage it, that where there is like political competition, that it is spilled over to the university, which is a, in a sense, the beating heart of the human capital machine, that shouldn't have been surprising, would it?
No, it shouldn't have been surprising, but, you know, human rights is a struggle. As the late author and Nobel Prize winner Wangari Maathai reminded us, that human rights cannot be given on a plate. They have to be struggled for, they have to be fought for. And I think the university itself took a central role in that. And I think then and even today, the university plays a key role in training, in ensuring that there is an enlightened citizenry. Many of the issues involving rights are issues that require a certain level of analysis that you need citizens to be able to appreciate. So definitely there was need for the university to get itself involved in some of these struggles, to get into the trenches. It cannot remain as an ivory tower. But when need be, the university had, the ivory tower had to get itself involved. And actually, if you're looking now at the struggles that the country is facing, we need to demystify the ivory tower and get out of the you know, the gates and go to the communities and try to you know, let them understand and appreciate the issues. The other thing that I'd like to point out, another key role that we have played over the years, both at the Human Rights and Peace Center and the university generally, but I think which is also important as a linkage to the work that Chapter 4 plays, is to provide that independent research and analysis. In the 1980s, the 1990s, you know, people clapped at the structural adjustment policies. There hadn't been much thought about what the impact will be. But the academia cried out and said, look here, we need to be careful about what is this is going to do. Removing the state from its core obligations to the people, the social contract. And this has come to pass. Right now, there is documentation on issues such as the narrowing civic space for NGOs to operate. Organizations such as Chapter 4 are playing a frontier role. They are the ones that are speaking out. But this can only be supported where you have empirical, independent, strong research that is coming from the academia. Research and evidence of, for example, state capture of institutions such as the judiciary, the faith institutions. So there is need for the academia to work hand in hand with civil society because they each play different roles at different levels and complement each other in this way. So I think my role really on the board of Chapter 4 is one where I really try to bring the two together, to marry the two together because they totally complement each other and they cannot do away with each other.
How is the Ivory Tower, particularly your place in it at the law school, framing human rights issues in Uganda in 2024? What are the key challenges today?
Let me first state that, first of all, the narrative of human rights is being challenged. Many times when we see legislative initiatives and we go as the academia to present, you know, our proposals about laws. For example, the compulsory land acquisition bill, and saying that, look here, this has human rights implications. You cannot take land away compulsorily as the state in the name of development without consulting, without compensation, without prior information. And the government is saying, no, look here, development first, human rights later. I think that is a very big challenge right now. And it is not just here, it is also global. Where many states are saying, let's first do the development, the rights issues will come in. And human rights practitioners are even being framed as anti-government, anti-development. So when, as academia, you try to frame human rights as paramount, you are labeled as anti-government. That is a very big challenge in itself. So the need, the importance of letting people understand, both in the classroom and outside the classroom, the requirement to observe human rights of individuals as the starting point, that you must, you know, observe the rights and dignity of everybody before other things come into play. You cannot take away the dignity of an individual because you're providing for them education or you're exploring oil. So that is one challenge that we are facing, that we need to reframe this conversation and bring back human rights at the core reframe human rights as not being anti-government, anti-state, anti-development, but being the first thing that we need to, because our constitution, because the Universal Declaration of Human Rights puts it that way. Article 1 of the Universal Declaration of Human Rights, all human beings are free and equal in dignity and rights. That's number one, the first thing, human being. And then the other things will follow. Some of the challenges that, other than that, that we are facing, of course, because, I mean, in the 1980s, we saw freer space. We saw a space that was more open to criticism of the government. We saw more academics freedom. We saw open civic freedom. To date, we are seeing a narrowing civic space for actors, for civic actors, including the academia. And this is manifested, for example, through transferred aggression from security actors. The moment there is a problem at the, a protest within on a critical issue, maybe about corruption, and the youth are coming out, the one thing that the security actors will do is to get to the universities and close the gates of the university so that there is no mass mobilization of youth from the university to join the streets, you know, to protest. So, and this aggression really of security agencies, I mean, I call it transferred because I feel that there are issues within the security agencies, within the individuals, within the payment, within the living conditions of the security actors that are not being catered to. So you see images of security agents arresting young protesters, peaceful protesters, and it is so violent, which is very, very unfortunate. And this sends a chilling effect to not only the student body, but also to the faculty and also to the communities outside, because the communities will see, okay, if the enlightened, the so-called intellectuals are handled like this, what about us, wananchi? So there is that transferred aggression. Of course, there are issues of individual and institutional safety. Before I say something, before I release a report, I'm going to think about, you know, myself, I'm going to think about my unit, I'm going to think about my institution. So there is caution. There is caution as we go on doing our work. Those are some of the challenges that we are facing as the academia. But this also is trickling into the other civic actors, into, you know, NGOs, into the faith institutions, that people are watching out for their safety first before speaking out on the other issues. So that fear, that caution is increasingly taking grip of our society, and it's coming on to us as well in the academia. We see this also through reduced funding, locally, but also globally. They are shifting donor priorities, so there's not much funding going around. And if you're looking at the priorities, academia is not going to be number one. Donors want to see tangible, you know, things in the communities, and maybe a report is not the one thing that they're going to be very much involved in. So the funding, but also, the limited appreciation to fund academia is another challenge.
I was going to say, Dr. Nampil, because you mentioned earlier that human rights issues should be central to the to political society, as well as to, you know, economic society, for instance. So where governments are dealing with complex social problems, their first point of call would be, have we taken care of the human rights implications of this or that policy? But that said, can human rights advances, even in a progressive society, ignore some of the things that Uganda is currently facing? For example, mass unemployment, competition for land, large rural urban migration, the influence of technology, social media, ideas that are globally present. Just to mention, for example, that since the Arab Spring, governments in the global south, in fact, governments everywhere, have taken a certain view to protests and their relationship with major changes in political formation. And now, given all of that, how do you, as as an academic and as a practitioner of human rights, how do you deal with those contradictions in such a way that, you know, can produce a result that is consistent with your ethics, your values, and your worldview?
We cannot be blind to the exterior forces, very powerful, and sometimes maybe too powerful for us to do much about. But that doesn't mean that we should not be alive to the fact that they do exist. If, for example, you look at the charcoal trade, I'll give you an example of a study that we are currently doing as the Human Rights and Peace Center. The charcoal, black gold trade in northern Uganda. The amount of trees, deforestation that is happening in northern Uganda and West Nile, okay, because of the huge need for domestic biofuel in the cities. And interestingly, that we are even exporting charcoal to Kenya, but also as far as Hungary and Saudi Arabia. And the president has gone ahead now to issue a directive. There's a presidential ban on cutting of trees and transportation of charcoal from northern Uganda. Our research shows that beyond northern Uganda, once the trucks are able to make it from northern Uganda, they are free to move freely in the rest of the country. So what does this really mean? It means that there are global forces outside. There is demand for this fuel that the government has perhaps not thought through. What do you do for the demand for domestic fuel in the cities down south? That the options of livelihoods for Ugandans in the southern part of the country, the options for fuel in terms of electricity, in terms of gas, are too expensive. 94% of Ugandans use charcoal. So even if you have the presidential ban, have you put the person at the center to say, how do we actually go around this? People still need to have the charcoal. Yes, there are global agendas that are pushing for green energy. And yes, we want to decarbonize. But what does it mean for us? What are the dilemmas and contestations? You see, when we talk about human rights, they are basic, they are starting points. They are starting points of human rights that then expand on. And yes, we are talking about intersectionality, that all rights are meaningful, that they are important. But we are talking about the right to life, the right to exist, the right to food. There is that person in northern Uganda who only has a piece of land upon which to cut the trees and sell charcoal to get a livelihood, because you know the part of the country where he lives is just recovering from war. Okay, and what where is the support coming from the state? What options does he have? Those are limited. We don't have free healthcare per se. You know, education in most instances has to be paid for. So there are still questions about the basic, the starting point of human rights for people's existence. That social contract that the government has agreed, has signed on to take care of its citizens. Let me give you another example of a study that we recently concluded. A study on the manifestations and scope of militarization in Uganda's development sector. We took a case study of the fisheries. In 2017, the president issued another presidential directive banning fishing on all water bodies in Uganda. Well and good, the justification was that there is overfishing, people are fishing, even premature fish. We need to let the lakes revive. This was overnight. The fisher folk were not warned. Their houses were burnt to remove them from the lakes. They were not given options. And how many years later? They have not returned to the lakes per se. And actually we are seeing the technical civilian personnel who used to man the lakes the Uganda Police Force that used to man the lakes is off the lakes up to now. The UPDF that used to patrol the lakes to keep people away from the fishing.
That's
is
the Uganda
now,
People's Defense Forces.
Yes, the Uganda People's Defense Forces has now become the new fisher unit. Military personnel are now fishing and now taking some money, taking bribes from fisher folk to allow them to resume their fishing.
There's an illegal underground fishing economy that has replaced what was there before without solving the problem of immature fishing.
We are removing our military from, you know, the places where they're supposed to be, putting them, in civilian spaces. We are compromising them. But at the end of the day, we have not put the individual first. So we're talking about we want to grow the fish so that we can have a big fishing export. Export to benefit who? Where is the citizen benefiting from?
I think we have to thresh these issues in some detail next time we host you on this podcast, because the sense I'm getting is that where you have a complex set of development challenges, a fairly complex political history and social history, centering human rights both in public policy and perhaps even in the way that academia approaches it, that can be a very complicated matter. So as we end this particular episode, what are going to be your priorities for the coming year? There's an election around the corner. 2025 is an election year. And as you mentioned before, the academia, particularly Makerere University, where you sit, will be front and center of the political contestation and, I dare say, the human rights issues embedded therein.
Yes, indeed. Number one, with this election coming and other issues that are manifesting, we cannot, as a university, keep away from the sensitive governance issues. We have to meet them. We have to deal with them. We have to deal with them with the means that we have, you know, through training, through research. The other thing that we need to do is to strengthen the collaborations with other actors. We cannot work in isolation. So there is a need for stronger collaborative, mechanisms in country as well as transnational. That is one way also of couching ourselves. I talked about the institutional and the individual safety. So collaboration is just as important. We need to bring on board the private sector. We need to bring on board everybody. History reminds us we need to draw upon the past in order for us to frame our understanding and behavior of the present. If we do not want a recurrence of the killing of a vice chancellor like happened to Frank Kalimuzo because he was fronting sensitive political issues, if we don't want a recurrence of violations that we have distanced ourselves from and committed to keep away from in our constitution, then we need to allow that space. We need to learn from our past experiences. We need to allow the space for everybody to exist, academia and other actors. And we need to follow our laws and respect the human rights of everybody in this country. We need to center the human being at the conversation, at the discussion of governance and human rights in this country.
Dr. Nampeo Sahara, thank you so much for appearing on this Legacy Podcast series by Chapter 4. We look forward to seeing you here again sometime.